Good morning. I'm Fran Michel, and I'm here with Desiree Helligers, old mole, activist, professor, writer, poet, playwright, and now performer, to discuss her new web series, 30 Days on a Silent Buddhist Retreat, or How I Learned to Breathe Through the Apocalypse. So tell us about what this project is and how it came about.
Yeah, so this is the second episode in the series, and I think there's probably going to be about six or seven. And basically, it's strongly rooted in an experience I had at two silent retreats in 2005. So one of them was in August of 2005, and I'm not a very advanced Buddhist practitioner, but somehow I ended up following a friend who was going on this long retreat and went on a week-long silent retreat in the woods outside of Vancouver, BC, and I was in this sort of what I call a godforsaken Lutheran church camp, you know, where it's like, you can't get away for a whole week. You're stuck in this church camp. And there's no access to media. It was silent and only what they call functional talking. And at the end of a week of that, you know, feeling very much like I had eaten some mental minty breath mint that was just like blowing through my head. And I was feeling all peaceful and elated. And we crossed over the border back into the US, and the border guard said some version of New Orleans is gone. And we were like, what? While we were at this camp out in the woods, Katrina had hit. And it made me think seriously about the sort of whiteness factor of being in pretty much an all-white group, very middle class, very comfortable in this setting. And to see the disparity of what was playing out in New Orleans, and also to see sort of, I would say, a really great example of samsara, you know, the concept of illusion playing out, where white residents of New Orleans were being industrious and finding things in supermarkets and being very resourceful. Black people in New Orleans were being represented as, you know, marauding and looting, and these survival behaviors were read in very, very different ways. And so that to me was sort of a dramatic illustration of one element of these retreats that can be, you know, very insular, very privileged, very comfortable. And the question of, you know, what do we do in those spaces and how does it relate to kind of the tragedies that are playing out around us? And so from that retreat, which was like in August 2005, I ended up going to a month-long silent Buddhist retreat somewhere close to that same godforsaken Lutheran church camp, in a godforsaken Lutheran church camp, and, you know, stuck out there basically for a month. And I am not a terribly advanced Buddhist practitioner. And I felt like I was meditating alongside these uber Buddhists who had been like meditating on Mount Olympus for a month before they even arrived at this retreat. You know, they just like oozed some sense of peace and of presence. And I was like, I want what they've got. But, you know, I ended up being sort of like a bull in a china shop in this situation. These kinds of retreats can get very, very intense. First of all, we're not used to spending long periods of silence like that. But also in this particular retreat, we had to do this kind of practice called orioki, which is kind of like an elaborate Buddhist hand ballet, is what I would describe it, when you're eating. So that even when you're eating, you are involved in a kind of meditative practice, and it's all done in silence. And so to me, it was kind of like a sort of nightmare version of having to have dinner with the grown-ups. You know, it just was very continually demanding and stressful in certain kinds of ways. And I ended up, I feel like, sort of parodying some aspects of my own response to that environment and how awkward and ridiculous I felt at times. And also kind of observing what I began to feel like I was sort of like this highly spiritually ambitious, wannabe Buddhist lab rat running a kind of maze or scientific experiment that was being observed by, you know, people who are sort of teaching and leading the retreat. And I want to be really clear that, you know, for me, this retreat actually was pretty transformative. When I finally was able to kind of settle down and really start meditating, there was a lot of things about it that really did change my life in certain ways. But I also think that I'm also skeptical of some very, you know, hierarchical kind of master-disciple relationships. And I bring that skepticism from my own kind of Catholic background. And so I found myself in this play drawing some of those parallels. This was also in the period, it was the regime of the younger President Bush. There were constant disclosures going on in this period of torture at Abu Ghraib. American foreign policy, US foreign policy, was just like a nightly little box of horrors on the news. And I felt really strongly compelled to try to kind of sit with silence and sit with those horrors and not try to kind of amuse myself to death in the ways that I think we are constantly encouraged to do. And this was 2005, so that we weren't continually deluged with some of the digital media that we're deluged with now, but it was still striking the extent to which spaces of silence are few and far between, and they can be very uncomfortable to contend with at first.
So the dissonance of coming back from the first retreat and hearing about Katrina and being aware of that striking juxtaposition and the privilege of being able to retreat into silence didn't put you off from further meditation retreats. You ended up going on an even longer one. In your description of the piece, you mention the shared complicity of privileged Catholicism and American Buddhism in accelerating American fascism and climate change. And yet it sounds like you also found the experience of the retreat a way of addressing your place in the world of fascism and climate disaster. So how do we see that complicity, and how is something that's complicit in those things also a way of learning to cope or address what's going on?
Mm-hmm. That's a can of worms, Fran. I'll just say that I think that there is a tendency among, and I'll speak mostly for sort of white middle-class Buddhists who were not necessarily raised in this tradition. We come to it for different reasons. And I think that there's a tendency, and this isn't necessarily from the practitioners themselves, but to throw around these terms like karma and samsara. And I think karma is, you know, one of those that's particularly problematic where people, oh my gosh, you know, I got too much caramel in my macchiato, right? And oh, it's just karma for you, whatever. People throw around these terms. And I find that these are ways of basically reinforcing inequalities that already exist, right? And they're ways of kind of trivializing them. And I think within Catholicism, there's a tendency to kind of fetishize salvation and in similar ways to, I think, fetishizing enlightenment. And the sort of downside of both of those is a disengagement from the reality of the injustices that are surrounding us, right? And a desire to kind of retreat inward rather than dealing with those political realities. But also, I'm interested in this concept of spiritual materialism that Chogyam Trungpa, who's the founder of Shambhala, actually uses this concept. And I kind of critique different aspects of Shambhala in the play. But, you know, one of the things he's basically saying is that there are different ways in which spiritual realization becomes this kind of fetish. It's like any other kind of material object that we hunger after. And so I think I spent some time kind of parodying my own ways in which I grew up as a Catholic wanting to be some kind of saint. And that I think there's sort of roots in white saviorism in some of that Catholic upbringing and some of that also desire to be an enlightened being, that these are, you know, especially for those of us who are white, who are very comfortable, who have a lot of privilege, these are ways often of disengaging from the political realities that we most need to engage. So I think the upside for me of this retreat and of both of these retreats and of practice in general is learning not to run from the horrors, is being able to sit and be present and not constantly looking for entertainment that can distract us from those realities. And we are distracted, obviously, at our own incredible peril right now, right? As the climate crisis is accelerating, as the U.S. is involved in more and more conflicts, and we are going on paying taxes that cause more and more suffering globally. And Gaza is obviously the most dramatic example of that. So many of us, most of us, I would say, are engaged in these different forms of escapism. And we can't afford to do this. War is inextricably linked to climate collapse. And we cannot continue to bomb around the world at the pace that we're doing without destroying the planet that we all rely on. And so I feel like meditation can be very helpful in terms of allowing us to sit with silence and to sit with deeply unpleasant realities. And also to sit with ourselves in our own unpleasant reality, you know, with meditation and silence, you're forced to contend with those voices that are rattling around in your own head and with the petty grievances that, you know, that we carry around. And so finding ways to sit in silence. And if you do that long enough, if you're following your breath long enough, you know, you're able to kind of step away from some of that internal garbage that it really stresses us out. And I think that's what we're trying to get away from is the internal garbage. Right? We're fleeing to all this other stuff because we don't want to come to terms with that. And I think for me, in this episode too, I sort of come to terms, I think, with the extent to which flashbacks to Vietnam are a part of the detritus that we grew up with as children, those of us who grew up during the war, who didn't understand the war, who were watching footage of Vietnam between and among the cartoons that we were watching, right? We have no capacity to process those horrors. And so...
So the problem with American Buddhism in that view is not the Buddhism part, but the sort of fetishizing of enlightenment or turning what is a way to learn not to escape from the world into another form of escape.
Yeah, I think that's a good way to put it. Yeah, another kind of fetish. And again, it's like, I am not enough of a Buddhist practitioner to pose an encompassing critique of Buddhism. I don't have the knowledge, I don't have the expertise to do that. But I am looking at a particular kind of white middle-class consumerist Buddhism. A lot has been written about this. Certainly, I'm thinking of the book, you know, Make Mindfulness.
A lot of the humor in these first couple of episodes, at least, comes from your self-parody of that youthful wanting to embody the white savior and be a saint. It seems like the journey of this series involves making fun of precisely the kind of self-absorption that can be encouraged, that is encouraged in American culture, but also in some of the ways that meditation has been taken up in American culture.
Obviously, war is a whole other, you know, strong emphasis in it. And in this episode, I tell this somewhat horrifying story about how I accidentally killed my father. And of course, for me, that trauma is something that emerges in meditation. You know, you often have very, very vivid flashbacks to even trivial incidents. And in this case, you know, it was a really transformative event that happened when I was 17. I was on a trip with my father in Europe. And I think I'm interested in kind of the disparity between my very insulated privileged upbringing and my father's not so insulated privileged, you know, and not so privileged upbringing. You know, even though he came from a pretty wealthy Catholic family, they were anti-fascists and had been going back probably to World War I at least. And he had his brother, my Uncle Pierre, had suffered brain damage at birth and was also a twin. And I don't think Nazis really cared whether your particular disability was congenital or subsequent, right? The chance that he could have ended up being essentially experimented on, both my uncles experimenting on in the death camps, Dr. Mengele, that is a reality that my father's family, I mean, there are many reasons why they left the Netherlands when the Germans invaded, but that was a primary one. And so to me, the fact that he died almost 39 years to the date of the German invasion of the Netherlands was sort of a kind of example of the way in which war explodes across decades. Ordnance explodes literally across decades. I mean, in Vietnam, even in Europe, a buried ordnance is constantly still going off. I mean, certainly in Vietnam it is, occasionally in Europe, but constantly in Vietnam. The landscape is just still littered with American mines and American-made bombs and all the rest of it.
And capitalism is still littered with the corporations that collaborated with the Nazis. There's a segment in this second episode where you talk about your father's experience in his family escaping from the Nazis and your visit to Anne Frank's house, but also you have a sort of riff on all of the corporations that were complicit, and they're all still with us. This long list of the unending profit of war profiteers.
Yeah, I mean, I think the political economy of the Third Reich, you know, like the political economy of American fascism, doesn't get talked about concretely enough. And we act as if that's somehow this impenetrable technicality that we don't want to talk about. But we've still got the jingles from all those companies running through our heads 40 years after we've heard them. And so I do try to make familiarizing ourselves with those corporate collaborators with the Nazis to make that memorable. And it's pretty easy to remember these companies, right?
Although the list of companies to boycott for their past and current atrocities makes it very hard to actually engage with purchasing anything. We're all sort of trapped in.
Yeah, in this juggernaut. Yeah,
the current market.
Well, we're obviously taking up the issue of boycott, divestment, sanctions very immediately now. And I just think that we have to be very strategic and thoughtful about, you know, how we decide to focus those kinds of campaigns. But again, these are areas that if we're not thinking about them and we're not acting on them, these corporations are continually metastasizing, right? The corporate malfeasance, the militarism, the destruction to the planet that they're causing, we cannot afford to tune out of these things, right? And so this piece, I think, tries to deal with both the real tragedies of war as it played out in my own family, but also as we witnessed growing up looking at these horrors in Vietnam, right? How do we make art in ways that is both kind of materialist, precise, and also engaging enough that people can, you know, struggle with those horrors. And this is maybe just some little piece that does a little bit of that. I don't know.
Do you want to talk a little about the process of putting together this series through Open Signal with collaborators? In watching it, there are some amazing reminders of 60s television and commodity culture and all sorts of things that come in relation to your talking about your youthful experience and putting it in context of the wider world and your spiritual aspirations. How did it all come together as a project?
I wrote a lot of this literally on that retreat. I mean, on that month-long retreat, somebody had given me journals right before it. So I took a ton of notes as it was playing out. And then Daria Ruggles got kind of dragged into this project. Daria had been a student of mine like 20 years ago or something. Daria had had an earlier life as an actor. She was on Days of Our Lives. She'd had a talk show also in Seattle. She'd had a public affairs show on Open Signal. So she was really the one who brought in the kind of technical capacity, including, you know, being able to shoot at Open Signal. And so Daria was doing a lot of the editing and work on it. And then she got a great job as a union organizer, and she is just a powerhouse of an organizer. So she's got, you know, so many projects in motion that she really had to pull back. And then Open Signal connected us with Melissa Salazar, who has just been an amazing, she's just contributed so much to the project. Because Melissa does a lot of motion graphic work and has taken on a lot of the editing of this episode. So it's just gotten more kind of layered as different people have come into the project. I mean, nothing's ever really a solo production. So yeah, they both have just brought so much to the project. And I had never really done any acting before, and which is probably pretty obvious. But so Daria was really directing my acting part of the production and was just so helpful. Initially, I was trying to get her to act it. I tried to get other people to act it. And Daria was like, no, I think you need to do it yourself.
So there are two episodes completed. One of them I know is on YouTube. All of them will be broadcast through Open Signal.
Yeah, I would say by the beginning of May, and hopefully on The Mole, we can do a little plug for it when it's released.
Can you give us a preview of the first episode is sort of your childhood fantasies about becoming a saint. And then the second episode is sort of centered around that teen experience with your father. What is to come in later episodes?
It definitely gets more into the disclosures that are going on in Abu Ghraib and other stuff related to climate collapse. And I think I really want to make connections to Ernst Becker's book, The Denial of Death, which is a book that I've just found so influential, the way that he talks about the links between the denial of death and fascism. You know, this constant emphasis on the afterlife, constant emphasis on achieving other states that don't really have to do with this world. I think it kind of tackles some of that. And also, you know, I think there's elements of it that might be described as cringe comedy because of the awkwardness, my personal awkwardness, in what I can only describe as like basically a human chessboard, perfectly silent human chessboard of 40 advanced Buddhist practitioners. And I'm the one that has literally ADHD and is having sporadic panic attacks. And, you know, I'm just kind of erupting in different ways that I find deeply humiliating. But there's other aspects of these retreats that just have to do with bodily functions that we want to deny in the same way that we want to deny death. You cannot sit at a Lutheran church camp and eat a daily diet of tofu for 30 days without things that erode your attachment to ego. When there's, I'll just say that the plumbing at the second church camp starts to give out. And what you end up with is 30 people standing in front of a stall, a single stall, in total silence. So those are some of the things that you might look forward to.
In the second episode, you have a riff on the body counts and whether the body counts, and that division between body and spirit and the devaluing of the body and the question of how much the body does ultimately count.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's very difficult for us to really come to terms with the pain of other people in, you know, living under bombs when we're so immersed in fetishizing the soul. and imagining states of release constantly. And I really feel like, I guess, this second episode in particular kind of is engaging both World War II, you know, the Third Reich, as well as the war in Vietnam. And in some ways, my interpretation of this material is shaped also by having made a trip to Vietnam with Veterans for Peace in 2015 and visited, for example, the War Remnants Museum in Ho Chi Minh City. And, you know, I can only describe some of that exhibit as feeling like some horrific jack-in-the-box full of atrocities. I walk in there and all of a sudden I see all these images of the war in Vietnam that I saw as a child and have not seen since. So it's like, you know, we go around, the U.S. goes around the world breaking things, dropping ordnance, eviscerating forests. And then we take away all this, you know, all the signifiers, all the signs, all the history is erased. And it's back to this kind of culture of denial. And so I really feel like for people of our generation that, you know, when we sit in silence, that's some of what we have to contend with, is those images, those memories that we're always keeping at bay with just endless trivia. And the question is, you know, how do we really be present and accountable to the harms that our country has caused and is causing? And the fact that this planet cannot continue to exist with U.S. militarism funding endless war and destruction. And Biden can talk all he wants about sending floating docks to Gaza, but we know that the U.S. is providing so much of the weaponry. We have to kick this addiction to war, and we have to find ways to be present to the suffering. And I do feel like meditation can be useful for that.
So for all that in that description, you mentioned the complicity of American Buddhism and certain Catholicism with fascism and climate collapse. There are ways these traditions have been used as, here's another form of escape and denial of death, but also they can, in some uses, make us more present and able to come to grips with the disasters of our world, where the body counts.
Yeah, I think that's a really good way to put it. I mean, I'm still engaging with Catholicism. I was raised Catholic. I have many, many issues and debates with Catholicism, but I also feel like Catholicism for me was a window also into left politics. But yeah, I do think that there are definitely elements of these traditions that are extremely valuable.
Thanks so much, Desiree, for talking with me today, to telling us about your hilarious, heartbreaking web series.
Thank you,
Fran.
How
to Breathe Through the Apocalypse.
Yeah, thanks so much.